Patricio de Real is Associate Professor of Art and Architecture at Harvard University. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Constructing Latin America, Architecture, Politics, and Race at the Museum of Modern Art. Patricio, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to join you on the podcast of Dr. Class.
You've just written this book about Latin American modern architecture and the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, as it's called for short. You talk about having been the curatorial assistant for a major 2015 show there about Latin American architecture. I know that's the genesis of the book, but could you tell us with a bit more detail about how you got the idea for this book? When did you know you wanted to write a book?
I will actually go back, way back, to always being curious of Latin America, what Latin America was while growing up in Puerto Rico with Cuban parents. Growing up in the Caribbean, in Puerto Rico, the question of identity or belonging was always kind of there, is always in the air. So that brought with me a curiosity about this region, this idea called Latin America. So that's a question I've been pursuing from different perspectives for a while, I could say. But again, to answer directly your question, is that the genesis of the book was my PhD dissertation that I did when I came to New York in 2005. So that's the start of trying to manage it within a theoretical construct. It's interesting because I originally intended to write or do research on the impact of informal housing in modern architecture in Latin America. And this was actually came about from research that I have been doing in Cuba, actually informal housing in Cuba. So my research took a different turn, let's say. During the PhD studies, when I did a course on architectural historiography, I took on this quite prominent US architectural historian, Henry Russell Hitchcock, who had done this seminal exhibition at MoMA, Latin American Architecture, since 1945. This is a show that everyone cites and everyone has a comment about it, but no one has really looked deeply into this exhibition. And I thought it really deserved much more focused research, but also to take it from different angles than the ones that have been cited. And it was generally used in the scholarship and in the world of architecture.
So you went from informal housing to the MoMA.
Yes. To Paul, completely different Paul. All right. But all within the history of modern architecture. I was always very interested in understanding how the discursive practices, the way we talk about modern architecture, conditions our ideas of the world, how we interpret the world, how we map the world. Why is the informality, right, or slums, whatnot, was positioned in a particular way in the histories of architecture or not at all, right? That was kind of my interest. So when I shifted to the idea of Latin America, it did retain the element of the narratives and the story of modern architecture, right? That has become very, very important in the study of architecture.
So you decided to write this dissertation and then this book. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a bit about some of the obstacles you faced researching the book?
One of the things that changed from the dissertation to the book, perhaps one of the obstacles, was the emphasis on the focus on race, which was something that at the time I was doing the dissertation, to be very honest, people did not feel very comfortable in supporting. I really did want to, with the book, go back to all my research and go back to the conception of the book and understand how the question of race and then the question of genders played within this larger narrative. It's interesting that even some people cautioned me against using the word race on the title, which is, you know, interesting how things have changed from then to now. So the book does take on those two questions, race and gender, and it continues with the theme of politics, right, which was there from the start. In that sense, to be also honest, I think one of the obstacles was the writing of one of the chapters, chapter 3 on Brazil Builds, because this is an exhibition that has been very well studied. But because it was well studied, One, I didn't really want to write about it because everything has been said, you know, what can I add? But then because I returned to this question of race and the question of gender, I started to build on this and really amplifying, if you will, or reconnecting this exhibition to a question which I found very important and I truly believe is there, which is this construction of race that is fundamental to understand the imaginary of Latin America in the United States and how this mobilized and used in exhibitions at the Museum of Modern Art in this case. So what I tried to do then is to follow these threads and see how they are then connected beyond architecture exhibitions into fashion magazines, into general popular culture in the United States. And of course, how it's also connected with the governmental apparatus, if you will, the Office of the Coordinator of Inter-American Affairs and the machinery of Pan-Americanism in this particular case with Brazil Builds, but then how that continues in different ways after Brazil Builds and how actually it's already inaugurated in exhibitions before this seminal show that everybody kind of knows, which is Brazil Builds. The question of acquiring photographs became a complication because I was actually finishing the book during the pandemic. So archives were closed. It took a lot of work and a lot of goodwill and help from people, for example, at MoMA, who actually went beyond. They were incredibly helpful in order to acquire photographs that actually have never been seen before of particular shows. That is one of the most recent obstacles, if you will, of developing the book.
One of the things that really fascinated me was how you were always bringing out these threads, but you still use the structure of this exhibit and that exhibit and that exhibit. So would you mind telling our listeners what were the major exhibits?
Well, there were large, very complicated exhibitions that now you look back and you wonder, how did they get away with this? You know, without the internet, without communications that we have today. For example, 20 Centuries of Mexican Art that was done in 1940. And it's a massive, massive show. It occupied the entire modernist building of MoMA. We have Brazil Builds that was done in 1943. And then, of course, Latin American architecture since 1945, which was staged in 55. But then there were also smaller shows that perhaps are not as blockbusters, if you will, such as From Le Corbusier to Niemeyer. There's a series of shows that then are also woven into other events or symposia in which I try then to create this tapestry of projects, of shows, of exhibitions. What the book argues is what I call the serial function of exhibitions, is that we should go beyond studying single exhibitions and that we need to see how they are intertwined and interconnected and how these leave a curatorial trail through, in this case, MoMA as the institution. I would argue that this happens in every museum. They have this curatorial trail that you can start putting together so you can understand how exhibitions press on curatorial agendas of a cultural institution like MoMA.
But don't you think that changes according to the curators, or do you think there is an institutional vision?
I believe there's both. And there's then the conflict between both. I truly believe that institutions have a mission and that they move forward with that mission. In this case, I believe that MoMA had a very clear agenda of establishing a cultural center of modernism in the United States. This was the called project, and many scholars have argued for this and I think proven this without any doubt. But also then you have the internal agendas of the people who form the institution, which are very important. So what the book does, it looks at the confrontations, the moment of crisis, if you will, the tears in the tapestry when curators have a confrontation. To give you a very clear example, in 1946, to the surprise of many, Philip Johnson returns to MoMA. Philip Johnson had left in the mid-30s to establish a fascist party in the United States. He was a declared fascist. Then he went supposedly through a period of conversion of non-fascism. There's much to be argued about that. But nonetheless, he entered the U.S. military. He went to Harvard, became an architect. And then suddenly in 1946, he returns to MoMA. First, not officially as an advisor. And then in 49, he becomes a director again. So when he comes back, he is gung-ho to establish his agenda and starts to have confrontations with not only curators, but also some of the people who have long worked at the museum. It's very interesting because at this time, because of the war, a lot of the men have left either for the war front or for Washington, and then women are put in charge of many of the curatorial departments and their curatorial agendas. So when Philip Johnson comes back in 46, he has these confrontations with Elodie Corder. And Elodie Corder, who's a fascinating figure, she is the director, the head of the Department of Circulating Exhibitions since its inception in the early 30s. She is really the person responsible for MoMA's projection outside of New York. She's a fabulous figure, an incredible figure that deserves much, much, much more research on her. But to put this story short, this intense confrontation, and there are all these really interesting memos back and forth between Johnson and Corder. And in the end, what happens is that she resigns. And then Johnson is able to, at least within the Department of Architecture, to complete the takeover. And this is a very interesting moment, again, as you pointed out, of the curatorial agendas of departments that are either being supported or contested or criticized by the overall museum. So we have these two institutional missions, and then who are the people who actually determine the institutional mission? It's a moment of great crisis at the museum and this return of Philip Johnson, which is something that needs to be explored even further. It speaks to the volatility of the institution, but also the period itself.
Speaking of gender, you had talked in the book of not just her, but of all these women who kind of took over MoMA and other museums. Even though you do mention some post-war women photographers and art critics, but I don't get a good sense from your book about what actually happened to women curators post-war at MoMA in particular and US museums in general. So what was the role of women in post-war cultural management?
Well, the book focuses on the Museum of Modern Art, and then we could argue if this is a microcosm of the other cultural institutions in the United States or not. We could draw parallels, but I can only speak to this particular moment at MoMA. We do know that through the ranks, some brilliant women are able to rise through the ranks in the architectural department, like Elizabeth Mock, for example, very important figure that becomes director of the department. Until, again, this moment when the war ends, the men are coming back to occupy the positions that they used to have. And this is also why the return of Philip Johnson is very troubling in that way. I put this in the book, this very fascinating memorandum, a confidential memorandum to one of the advisors of Abby Aldrich Rockefeller on the amount of power that women had amassed in the museum because of the war. Basically, in the end, they're saying that the museum is filled with feline gossip, for example, that women are having way too much power. This is comment about pussy pants. I'm really not familiar, but it sounds actually quite derogatory, but also about a museum that is, in a quote, infiltrated by Jews. This incredible radiography, radiografía in español, one would say, of the culture of the moment during the war that speaks to that period, captured in this one memorandum that in the end called for the return of the good businessman. What is fascinating is that this is actually forwarded to Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, who's one of the three women who have founded the Museum of Modern Art. I never found a reply to this, so one never knows exactly how this was taken by Abby Aldrich Rockefeller. One can only guess. But nonetheless, it is clear that it was felt that this type of conversation, this type of commentary was not only allowed, but also needed. That tells you a lot of the position of women in cultural institutions at this time. And then the fact that as the war starts to end, the men start to come back and women are either being demoted or they find that there's not a good working atmosphere and they start to quit. That was a situation that women curators were suffering at MoMA at the time.
Do you think gender makes a difference in how you shape a museum?
I think we all experience the world in different ways. So yes, I would argue it also has to do with the way that one is treated in particular cultural institutions. If one is given the merit or the value that one deserves, all of that affects the working relation and the working atmosphere that we have in any institution, not only at MoMA. gender is a way to experience the world and experience acultural institutions. I would say also, other than gender, an interesting facet will be also sexuality. For example, that most of the architecture department at MoMA have been gay men. So I think that also is actually quite an interesting frame to look at this interpersonal politics that are being created in these departments in quite intense situations. They are very difficult times. The war must have been incredibly difficult. I mean, one can only imagine. So you already have an intense situation and intense working relationship. So all this complicates the production of culture. And one could argue also marks the production of culture. So I think what the book tries to do without overdetermining the exhibitions is just to bring these questions, these relationships, and these confrontations to light. But in the end, also look at the exhibitions for what they are, exhibitions, and look how they were composed, look what are the ideas, how the staging was performed, what architectural ideas were tried. Even with all of these problems, even with all these conflicts, people still did the work and they still produced these amazing shows.
Well, just keeping on the subject of gender and sexuality a minute, I was really interested in your descriptions of how MoMA exhibits in Latin American architecture in general were projected in fashion design in home magazines. Can you talk a bit about that?
So I found it quite fascinating, that connection. I also find it quite fascinating, the ability to trace these relationships, to trace this kind of ideas more than just simple echoes, right? But be able to actually find that, for example, the Office of the Coordinator of Inter-American Affairs was very much invested in creating these networks, these inter-American networks. So it's not only that we see an article on Peru, for example, in Peruvian fashion or Mexican architecture or Brazilian architecture, right? As an echo, there was Pan-Americanism in the air. We can argue for the soft reverberations, but when you actually look at the archives, you can actually see that it's constructed, that there is political will, that there is also political value to create these imaginaries through the shelter journals or the popular press. The way they are interpreted, well, that's beyond the mechanisms of creating the circulation, but it was clear because of the concept of psychological warfare that we had to create an atmosphere in the United States to change the long-held stereotypes of Latin America, that such infrastructure had to be created. The coordinator of Inter-American Affairs, that afterwards became the Office of Inter-American Affairs, operated very much to produce that change. And they would mobilize every possible means that U.S. culture and then U.S. commerce could actually do. So it's actually very fascinating when you have a building in Brazil done by Lucio Costa in Rio de Janeiro, which is an upper class, upper middle class apartment building in Rio de Janeiro that suddenly appears in House Beautiful. How could this happen? Well, obviously, there is a whole machinery that has been going on for some time. But then what one starts to look at on these travel articles is that in 1950, to my surprise, these type of articles were actually promoting the racial ideology of Brazil, of miscegenation. They were actually blatantly in the 1950s saying, oh, look at Brazil. Look at this wonderful modern architecture. Look at this wonderful open culture. It is the product of the mixing of the races. I mean, for me to say that in the journal in 1950s, it's outstanding.
Something I just couldn't get my head around, because you have this projection of idealized race relations in Latin America, and yet we're talking about a period that's way before the civil rights movement in the United States. And the United States government seems to be promoting it. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit about that?
I can only point to the evidence that I found. How do we overall explain this bizarre mobilization? I think we much more research has to do in relation to architecture, culture, and everyday culture. One of the aims of the book, what I wanted with the book, is to really start to build, at least as an example in relation to MoMA, this relation between the Americas, how ideas, cultural notions, even cultures of race, actually circulating across the Americas to actually shape U.S. culture. That is not only, you know, the United States exporting culture to Latin America and to the world, but actually the United States is actually receptive of cultural project for better or worse, that are being produced in Latin America. And I think what the book actually proves is that one of these poles is the Museum of Modern Art. It's a node of circulation of ideas that are produced in Latin America. And they are sort of a node in a center of propagation. It's not only that these exhibitions were shown in New York, these exhibitions traveled across the entire United States. Brazil Builds, it was performed for the first time in 1943, but it actually circulated across the United States, you know, to high schools, to community centers, till 1950. So we have this promotion of these beautiful modernist architecture, these tropical environments, but also still in the 1950s, as this House Beautiful article proved, connected to this racial ideology. Of course, it's completely idealized, right? Racial ideology, but I think if one starts to then locate it in the context of what is happening in the United States, it has to do also with the fact that the United States has gone out from a white supremacist war, right? The United States is still segregated legally. For better or worse, Brazil, Mexico, and you know, Latin America perhaps as a whole is imagined as an alternative, right? Let's look what's happening there, because it seems that they got it right. Somehow they got it right. And we could learn something from Latin America. And this was very clear with Brazilian modernism when Brazil Built was staged. You know, this argument of we can learn from Brazil was very clearly stated by the museum. Now, which lessons that we can argue in a more hilar más fino, as they say in
Spanish, right? Well, when you're talking about which lessons, I'm also intrigued by this contradiction or tension between the projection of architecture as democracy by the US government in MoMA, sort of a modernizing transparency. But many of the countries that are being highlighted, like Brazil, Argentina, the relationship with post-coup Guatemala, they all had authoritarian governments. So is that at the time blatantly overlooking reality or wishful thinking, or what's going on?
I believe it's completely blatant overlooking reality, that it is quite intentional, and that is not innocent. The fact that, again, Brazil Builds overlooks and completely recasts Vargas, not as a dictator, like as a progressive presidency, that was crafted from the beginning. You know, that was political need, absolutely. The fact, for example, that MoMA and Hitchcock in 1955 completely overlooked that there is a military government in Venezuela, in Caracas, right, that is actually advancing all these great modernist works. Now, that is completely erased. That is part of the political agendas of the exhibitions. Absolutely. There's this undercurrent, right, within the discourse. This is very clear in some of the documents I found in the State Department, but you can actually hear very clear reverberations of this, that authoritarian regimes were necessary for the region. And again, this is when we go back to gender or racial biases that the U.S. imaginary has on Latin America, is that these people down there, they really need strong masculine figure, right? Or also there's the question of imagining Latin Americans as children. So they need a strong authoritarian father figure. There's a chapter that I titled Our Man at MoMA, where it's this very fascinating figure, René de Arnoncourt, who is representing MoMA, trying to expand their services, exhibitions, also of books, member centers, expanding membership. But he's also at the same time, this is 1945, he's also blatantly spying for Nelson Rockefeller, who is at the State Department at this time. And he is sent these fabulous letters where Rockefeller tells him, you know, I want you to, under the cover of MoMA, go and actually see what is the political temperature of the region, because there has been reports of great propaganda by the Soviet Union. You know, it's 1945, is the beginning of the formation of the United Nations. So there's need to know where Latin America sits politically. And D'Arnoncourt travels the region and he meets with all these people and he's actually gathering all this information. And one of these conclusions, the rise of leftist idea, it was that there's really not to worry because, you know, Latin Americans really cannot handle this kind of political ideology. Even the Soviets don't trust them because they're basically saying they're children playing at grown-up politics. So that should not be our concern. I think that's part of this instrumental and very obvious overlooking of the political realities and also the social realities of Latin American countries. It's also staggering that a person like René Dénoncourt is able to travel the region and talk about the no need to worry about social upheaval without considering the actual state of societies in Latin America. Again, I think this is simply an instrumentalized view of Latin America for a particular gain.
Throughout the book, you talk about the use of architecture as cultural propaganda and lay out a strong case of how exhibits were used to promote Pan-Americanism and later neoliberal corporate values. In other words, the exhibits, although they had high aesthetic value, were very political. Mm-hmm. But I'm really curious, you passingly mentioned the Cuban Revolution and the gap in Latin American major exhibitions at MoMA between the 50s and 90s. But why wasn't there more involvement during that period? It's not only Cuba, we're talking about the Sandinista Revolution, the conflicts in Central America. The whole world is watching. Why not MoMA?
It's an interesting gap. In the conclusion of the book, I start to bring out other projects too, an attempt to create exhibitions that intersect in somehow Latin America. So I don't believe this, that they were not paying attention. I think people knew, at least architecturally. And again, I'm always speaking from the Department of Architecture and Design, right? Which is one department within a very complex sort of institution. So it's not that they did not know. They know what was going on. And there were moments where the architecture was incorporated in shows. But by then, I think there are certainly many reasons. The agendas of the museum and of many museums, they change over time. Also, you need people who are invested in particular ideas, in particular regions, in particular themes, to actually carry forth particular projects. They're as complex as exhibitions. It also has to do with what agendas are institutionalized within the museum. And what is fascinating about MoMA is that MoMA does institutionalize its international projection, basically doing exhibitions abroad, et cetera, with what is called the International Program. It institutionalizes this group that aim to help in the international projection of MoMA called the International Council, which is basically a group of high-powered people from across the world that come as a group to help promote the project of the International Program. So within that, there are attempts to engage and re-engage the region in particular ways. I do believe that the Cuban Revolution makes things very sensitive and quite difficult. The ability to actually just in 1955, 54, 55, send the prime architecture historian to Latin America to gather examples and just put a show, right? I think by 1960, it's clear that you can't do that anymore. So the situation in the region actually has changed also. So that's actually quite important as an overall culture. At the same time, when we look at architecture culture itself, I think architecture culture in the United States and in the Department of Architecture is focused on the crisis of modernism. In what is seen in Latin America, one could argue that people at MoMA, particularly Arthur Drexler, who was the director of the department, would see that with the Hitchcock show, enough was done and no more was needed. And that kind of trajectory of modernism in Latin America resolved itself, if we will, in 1960 with Brasilia, and that nothing more needed to be said. And it's unbelievable because the Department of Architecture is completely silent on perhaps what is one of the largest architecture, engineering, and infrastructural projects of the mid-20th century, right? Which is Brasilia. I mean, a whole city being created. And what do they say? Nothing. Absolutely nothing, which is actually bizarre. Again, it is not that they're not cognizant of what is happening. There is a person there at MoMA, Emilio Ambas, who in 1976 will put the Luis Barragan show. So then that becomes a very important show. but it's completely conceptualized as a move away from this tradition of architectural modernism. With that, the cultural conditions, the cultural understanding, the cultural interpretations of the architecture that's being produced in Latin America has completely changed. And the world also has become quite bigger. Ambas also had, in the 70s, he had this amazing project on trying to develop industrial design in Latin America by creating an industrial design center in Buenos Aires that in the end never happens because of very complicated politics of Argentina. There's been interest, but then there has been very few projects that have consolidated.
You described the region as a, quote, architectural think tank. Is that still true today?
I hope so.
There's so much to talk about. I mean, we've only scratched the surface. People are going to have to read your book. But do you have a new project?
I do have several projects in the work. One, I'm taking up the longstanding research on the Valparaiso School, a project that I've been interested in for a very long time. And this has to do with a question of future or a future in architecture. Can architecture imagine the future that is architecture create or reopen spaces of hope? So that's a project that I'm restarting now.
That sounds fascinating. Anything else you'd like to add for our listeners?
I hope that people have the chance to check out the book. We're planning a book launch in Cambridge with Dr. Klass on October 4th. So maybe you can join us and I hope to see you there. And I hope you enjoy the book. And thank you for inviting me to share these thoughts.
You've been listening to Patricia Del Real, Associate Professor of Art and Architecture at Harvard University. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Constructing Latin America, Architecture, Politics, and Race at the Museum of Modern Art. Thank you for joining Faculty Voices, Patricio, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you so much.